Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. On Christmas Eve 2007, Judy and Wayne Anderson's daughter, Michelle, and her boyfriend, Joseph McEnroe, arrived at their home for a family meal. Unbeknownst to them, their daughter was armed with a loaded 9mm pistol, and McEnroe was carrying a .357 Magnum. Both parents were callously shot dead by the pair and their bodies hidden from view. 2.5 hours later, Michelle's brother Scott, his wife Erica, and their two children, Olivia 5 and Nathan 3, arrived at the house. Within the hour, they too had been pitilessly slain in an act of violence that was breathtaking in its scope and cruelty. With his highly anticipated third book, Paul Sanders takes the reader inside every day of the trial of Michelle Anderson with his customary attention to detail, from December 2015 until March 2016. And in a unique digression from his other works, Sanders includes something he has never done before, an interview with one of the killers, Joseph McEnroe, at Walla Walla Penitentiary. Banquet of Consequences is the first of two books of what came to be known as the Carnation Murders. Were the killings a premeditated act, or had the defendants acted in self-defense? And what of the deaths of Olivia and Nathan? Who shot them and why? It would not be an easy task for a jury to decide. The reader is taken into a world few of us who have ever received a jury summons will ever experience. The book that we're featuring this evening is Banquet of Consequences, A Juror's Plight, The Carnation Murders Trial of Michelle Anderson, with my special guest, journalist and author, Paul Sanders. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Paul Sanders.
It's an honor to be here, Dan. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Fascinating perspective. Once again, thank you for taking us somewhere where we normally don't go with this, and this is right in the juror's box with people making a decision on life and death and the consequences that you talk about in Banquet of Consequences we'll be talking about now. Let me ask, we alluded about that this is not the first book of the about the Carnation Murders. So tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to be involved with this, and maybe you could tell us about who you were there on behalf of at the trial. Tell us a little bit about who you were associated with and how you came to be in a position to want to and be able to write Banquet of Consequences.
It's a good question, Dan. Thank you. My story began in 2014. I, like many jurors around the country, was called for jury service. And in this case, it was a high-profile murder trial. The girl's name was Marissa DeBault. She put a hammer in her husband's head 5 times. 1,200 jurors were summoned. In the end, 16 were chosen. And then there was a final 12. I was one of the final 12. The trial was 6 months in length, 3 phases. And in the end, we ended up giving the killer life, or recommending life in prison without parole. Coincidentally, in that trial, a prosecutor used to show up. I think somebody who's been on your show, as a matter of fact, Juan Martinez, and especially when psychiatrists were on the stand. And we recognized him. He's a high-profile prosecuting attorney. And we all wondered, why is he here? What does he have to do with this case? That's not our prosecutor. It was Eric Bassett. Well, the answer was found out soon. Juan Martinez was actually scheduled to do our case, but another very similar killer, Jodi Arias, her trial, 5 months before ours, the jury hung on her trial in the penalty phase, the death penalty phase. So just a few months after my trial completed, I was working on Brain Damage, A Juror's Tale, my first book, the story of what it is like to be a death penalty juror. And I fought on a whim. I heard on TV there was going to be this short penalty phase retrial. This thing was scheduled to be maybe 6 weeks in length. And I thought, you know what, it might be interesting to go down there, maybe do a little blog, or journal it, and maybe post it online. I did that, and the response was unbelievable. It took time, but that trial also ended up 6 months. So I wrote my second book, Why Not Killer, Jurors Did, The Death Penalty Trial of Jodi Arias. And when that book was complete, I found myself, as many authors do when they're first starting out, I found myself broke. So I put a message out on Facebook. I've got a lot of followers. I'm honored to have every single one of them. And I put a message on Facebook and I said, hey, I'm looking to move, but it doesn't have to be in Phoenix, Arizona. Any ideas? And the suggestions came back worldwide, mostly around the country, but people said, move to Canada, move to Australia, move to Great Britain, move to New York, move to Boston. And I had a list of things that were important to me, and one of them was I need to have an income, aside from my book income, which was still growing. I need to have a roof over my head, and gosh darn it, the state needs to have a death penalty. Because if I do a trial again, I really only do death penalty trials. Old friend of mine wrote and said, why don't you come up here? I got a job and a roof over your head and you can do what you want. And I asked him, does Washington have the death penalty? He said, yes. And I moved to Washington. It was suggested by a girl by the name of Jennifer Wood. She had brought up before I moved up here, she said, you know, there's a really interesting trial that just occurred on Joseph McEnroe, but there's still to be a trial on Michelle Anderson and the Carnation murders. And that's how it started. I typically don't research before I sit in a trial every day. And the reason being is I want the impact of the case presented the same as what it might be to a juror. Jurors who are selected partly because they know nothing about the trial they're about to be seated on. And I like being right in that position. It's there's the dark side of trials, which is the victim and what happened to him, her, or them. And then there's the other side that I really enjoy, and that is what a juror must feel when they sit in a seat in a very formal circumstance, in a high-profile circumstance, and what do they feel as the information is fed to them on a day-to-day basis. And because of I have had that unique opportunity to sit in that seat, when I sit in the gallery, it is very easy for me to understand what they are going through. And, of course, my interpretation when I write it. The support I've had for this trial has been amazing. I've been honored to meet Pamela Mantle, who was the mother to Erica. Her son-in-law was Scott, and her two grandchildren were Olivia and Nathan. I was honored to meet four jurors from both the McEnroe trial and the Michelle Anderson trial. I built a connection with the prosecutor. I am just unbelievably grateful for that. And I also have become friends with Ben Anderson, who is the grandson to Judy, the son of Mary Victoria. And she was the daughter that called off the night of Christmas Eve not to join the family. She had been there 10 years in a row, but that Christmas Eve, she called Judy, left a message on the machine, and said she would not be attending because her son had a cold. So she and her son did not Christmas Eve. And from there, you know, the rest of the story, what happened.
For those people, and we'll take us very much like you say, the jurors are supposed to be impartial, so they can't have researched these kinds of cases. But there are the certain particulars that you knew at the time. You say this didn't automatically interest you, and you were invited in, so this fell into your lap. But tell us about the particulars of the crime as you knew it, and the public knew it, and probably the jurors knew it. What are those basic particulars that we spoke to in the introduction of what happened on Christmas Eve 2007 at the Anderson home? Just what the public would have known and you would have known at that time.
Very good. It was high profile in the Northwest, so pretty difficult to find a person in Washington who did not know at least something of the murders. But it was Christmas Eve on a damp, very damp, overcast day, and Michelle Anderson and her boyfriend of 2 years, Joseph McEnroe, arrived at her parents' residence, which was only a quarter of a mile up the driveway, because Michelle and Joe lived in a trailer just down the driveway, which was owned by Michelle's father, Wayne. He, for a year, let them live there rent-free. Very near to Christmas Eve, Wayne had said, "Michelle and Joe, you need to start paying rent, maybe a stipend, $500, $400 to $500 a month, and it would be a good idea to get a job," which neither one had. Michelle took offense to that. And at 2 o'clock on Christmas Eve, they walked up in Michelle's waistband. She had a 9mm. Joseph in the back, in his back under the belt with a shirt over it, he had a .357 Magnum, and he also carried an empty box with him. It would come to be known as a decoy box. Judy opened the door. One could smell the roast in the oven, the Christmas spice in the air. As she opened the door and greeted her son or her daughter and potential son-in-law, she hugged them. Wayne called over from his easy chair. He was watching the game on TV. Called over with Merry Christmas. And within about 45 minutes, while Joseph was wrapping presents with Judy in another room, Michelle pulled out her 9mm gun and fired directly at her father, Wayne. She missed. Joe came running out with Judy. Joe then fired his .357, the bullet contacting Wayne in the head, and Wayne died immediately. He dropped. Then Michelle and Joe cornered Judy, Michelle's mother, in the kitchen while Michelle was screaming, "Shooter, shooter," and Joe shot twice. The first bullet grazed her. The second one, when she was in a crouched position looking up, she faced the bullet of a .357 Magnum. The last words she heard were from Joe, and he said, "I'm sorry, Mom," and shot her. They then moved the bodies. They dragged them out to the shed outside. It was another 3 hours before her husband, Scott, Olivia, and Nathan came over. Michelle and Joe waited in the living room. When the door opened, welcoming the rest of the family, one could still smell the roast in the oven. Everything looked normal. The only thing not normal were Wayne and Judy were missing. And at some point, Scott inquired about it about 20 or 30 minutes after we were there. And at that point in time, mayhem broke out. There were about 16 bullets fired. The first to die was Scott. He was shot in the face by Michelle, fell on the living room floor. The attention then turned to Erica, who was with her two children, 5 and 3. And in a panic, she grabbed for a cordless telephone. She picked it up, called 911. She got through. It was an 11-second call. The voice connection was about 6.5 seconds. Enough to cry, but never really got words out. Then the phone was knocked out of her hand by Joseph, and he then proceeded to execute Erica, Nathan, and Olivia there on the living room floor. They left. When they left, they went down the driveway, past their single-wide trailer, another 3.5 miles down the driveway, locked the gate premises, at which time two police cars showed up at the bottom of the driveway. By law, they did not have cause to go to cross the gate because of the 911 call was said to have been a possible party call by the person who answered the 911 call. One could not tell exactly what the sounds were, so it's understandable she made the mistake. Nobody could think that something like this would happen. And about 52 hours later, after the police had left, after Judy's work, people at work were wondering where she was. She had never been late in the 17 years she worked there. And finally, Linda Teeley went directly to Judy's house the day after Christmas and entered the premises. And then at that point saw 3 bodies, went into a panic, ran to the back bedroom, called 911 from the back bedroom, stayed on the phone for about an hour with 911. She was extricated from the building. 6 bodies were ultimately discovered, and those were the Carnation murders.
Now you talk about the discovery of the bodies and then the police response. So how do police get on the trail of these two immediately? How does that work? Tell us about that process.
Question, Dan. Thank you. In this case, it was really very easy. The police arrived, and a lot of police helicopters, sheriff, anything King County arrived. And 20, 30 vehicles and a crime scene RV. And while all that was going on, which took about 3 hours for the full complement of all departments to be there, Michelle and Joseph drove up in their black S10 pickup, pulled over, and just so happened to walk up to Scott Tompkins, who would become the lead detective in the case, and said, "Hey, what's going on?" Pretending, of course, they were innocent. And Scott, not knowing anything, all he knew was, "I have a family member here. This is a probable death notification. It's a very difficult circumstance. And I'm going to have to break the news to Michelle that her family is deceased." And over the next hour and a half, Michelle sat in the front seat of the car with Detective Scott Tompkins. Another Detective Peters, sat in the back seat. And Michelle she was questioned for about an hour and a half. It was under the premise it was a dead note. Death notification, but what came out because of about a half hour of inconsistent stories both detectives figured out that it looked like Michelle was hiding something. And suddenly Michelle broke down and said, I did it. And then for the next 45 minutes, amidst a myriad of some untruths and lies, she confessed. And Joseph McEnroe did the same thing with Detective Pavlovich in his car, just 100 yards police, to find out who really the suspects were. The difficulty came in the fact that since both of them spent much of their confession with lies intermingled in them, right, their job was to figure out what really happened.
You talk about the confession that was gained from Michelle Anderson, but in that, of course, everyone looks for, and I'm sure the audience is interested in, the reasoning given behind this. Sometimes we talk about abuse or humiliation from the parents or neglect. Tell us a little bit about the background here of the parents and what the excuse was, what the reason was that Michelle gave for not only the argument that led to the murder, but also talk about the disagreement, longstanding disagreement she had with her brother Scott.
Michelle was an overweight, somewhat felt or somewhat entitled girl, spoiled by Judy. Judy only wanted the best for her daughter. Judy worked for the post office for 17 years. Wayne worked for Boeing for over 20 years. Wayne was retired, Judy was not. And they were your typical middle America parents. They wanted the best for their children. They wanted the best for their retirement. And they cared about the community around them. Judy, a year prior to this, had learned that Michelle was dating Joseph and they were living in Kent, Washington, out in an area near Berrien, Tukwila, area like that, and probably not the best area of all. And they were living in an apartment, and Michelle had called Judy at some point and said, I'm nervous about living here. Somebody tried to break in. We're kind of in a bad area. And Judy, being her mother, said, you know what? Why don't you come live up here? I'll even give you a job at the post office. And we've got a residence for you. And you know what? Go ahead and bring Joe. And so they came up. They moved into the single wide. And they lived there rent-free. Joe worked for a number of Targets. Michelle worked part-time for the post office, pretty much two, three days a week, a job given to her by her mother. About a year and a half, about 6 months before the murders, Michelle quit her job at the post office, saying that thing on her, and they were talking about her behind her back. And Joe even helped with her quitting. He, with Michelle, went into the postmaster's office, and eventually they were asked to leave because voices were raised, and Michelle was adamant she had been screwed by somebody. Well, these same resentments were the same resentments building with her family. Wayne felt she had lived there long enough without working and increased the pressure on her to say, A, you need to get a job. B, you need to pay rent. You're not just living here. This was supposed to be a transition for you. Michelle took offense to that. She also, her brother loved her very much. And where the dynamic gets really weird is the fact that when Scott, her brother, married Erica Henshin, stayed with Erica. He eventually had two children with Erica. It's understandable his attention would be more on Erica than on Michelle. But Michelle was living in this world that things had, were not like her childhood. They had changed, and she was not accepting of it. But she took whatever help Scott would give her, like maybe working on her 80s Camaro IROC. He spent a lot of time replacing the engine, giving her money for parts. She then paid him to fix the car. For whatever reason, the car just never got running. And instead of Michelle being grateful for her brother's help, she got very angry. And she built up this number in her head that he owed her $30,000. So her intent on Christmas Eve was to get her $30,000 back. And the way she would do that is she would go to her father first, and she blamed her father for not coercing Scott into giving her money. She blamed Wayne for not supporting her cause and loving Scott more than her. So when she and Joe walked in on that Christmas Eve, the first thing she asked, once the pleasantries of Christmas were done, the first thing she asked of her father is, "I need you to get my money from Scott." And nobody knows exactly what Wayne said, but one can imagine that Wayne had been patient for the prior year with her living on his property rent-free. One can imagine he probably didn't take very well. He could not have anticipated she would whip out a gun and fire at him. But in her mind, everything was about her getting screwed over by everybody, and now she was going to put her foot down, and come hell or high water, she was going to get her money. In the end, when she searched the pockets of the victims, she pulled $40 out of Scott's pocket. She somehow missed the pocket with $3,000 in it. So maybe that's a karma thing, who knows. But this whole argument was about money and her feeling she was entitled and a deep-seated evil jealousy.
Seems like these aren't the, once again, the brightest criminals ever. And with this, the police take advantage of that and get a confession. Tell us just briefly about what the police want to elicit from her and what they do get from her to be able to prosecute Joseph McEnroe.
What they wanted from Michelle is they wanted her to talk, just talk. Because if you've ever met Scott Tompkins or somebody like Detective Flores or Mike Bishop from My Trial, it's not as much like TV where you feel like the detectives are laying all this pressure on the suspects. In fact, it was quite the opposite. The more Detective Scott Tompkins let Michelle talk, the more she would say. By having her say whatever she says, truth or lie, the evidence at the scene will never change. So what they do is they take the words from both of the defendants and then ultimately line it up to the story that the crime scene tells them. So if they tell the truth, then the facts at the scene should line up. If they don't tell the truth, the suspicion falls into this: if you're not telling the truth, what are you hiding? So it's this balance that goes in. Joseph McEnroe, that with Michelle, you know, looking at her, except for the fact that she's this horrid murderess, but you pretty well know what you're going to get when you look at her or she talks. She's not a smart woman by any means. But you pretty much, lying or not lying, you pretty much can get a good idea of what she's about. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to do that. Joseph McEnroe, on the other hand, as it came out in the trial later, he was able to change his personality. Picture like a chameleon blending into a scene. That's what he was good, really, really good at doing. When he and Michelle concocted their story before they sat down with the police, they both kind of lined up at first. But once evidence from the scene didn't line up to the stories, and then the detective gets to prod further for more information to find out why this stuff isn't lining up, and what are you hiding, and what are you concealing? Is this consciousness of guilt? The detectives aren't saying this out loud, but they're thinking it. But Joseph was tricky, because on the surface, Joseph looks like this kind of a weird guy, kind of off, very solitary guy, speaks a little bit strange. You would never guess, once you talk to him, that he could be this a murderer of six. And when you looked at him as he was in 2007, Pamela Mantle, the mother to Erica, referred to him as Manson-esque. He had a black beard. He only wore black, as Michelle only wore black. Black beard, long, long, unkempt, stringy hair. Didn't pay a lot of attention to his personal appearance. Didn't like looking people directly in the eye. And some people I've interviewed for the book have said he struck them as creepy. But what really makes him frightening is when he was put on trial 8 years later for these six murders, the man responsible for putting a bullet in the victim of every victim's head except for Scott's. In prison, he rehearsed for 8 years how to change his affect, his personality, and his countenance. And I cannot remember the name of the movie with Richard Gere where he's defending this criminal, and you think this criminal is autistic or what have you, and then you find out in the end, oh my God, he played me. He's not the person he portrayed himself to be. That is Joseph McEnroe.
Wow. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop just for a second to talk about our sponsor for this evening, which is ZipRecruiter. A friend of mine who listens to True Murder just messaged me a few weeks ago to tell me about his experience with ZipRecruiter. He had started his company about 2 years ago, he said, and they were doing very well. Now, it's a small company with staff he had assembled from years of working in the field. But he said he recently had tried to find and hire one new employee to replace somebody who had finally retired from the industry. And he was having a hard time. So he said after he heard details on a True Murder episode about ZipRecruiter, he decided to check out what ZipRecruiter was claiming. And he looked at how ZipRecruiter worked, and he appreciated their choice of resume formats and really liked their unique mobile apply process, where, as promised, he said, he got a lot of applicants and very quickly, and in short order, found the new employee, the ideal employee, said, he was looking for. And he called me to thank me and sing the praises of ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. And that's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through this site within one day. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/murder. One more time to try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/murder. Paul, we were just talking about what was happening with the two people involved in this murder, Michelle Anderson, and so talk about the trial of Michelle Anderson, which you chronicle day by day, basic journal of what happens at her trial. Before we talk about the fateful interview you have with the other murderer in the Walla Walla Penitentiary. So tell us a little bit about what lines up at this trial for Michelle Anderson. Tell us a little bit about some of the particulars and the dynamics that are there from the very beginning.
Very good. For Michelle Anderson's trial, 1,500 jury summons went out. From day one, I was there, and jury selection for a high profile murder trial, typically a jury is not actually selected for about a month. So the days of jury selection are important to me. They're important because I want to know, as in this case, how in the world are you going to pick somebody to sit down and make a decision on a person's guilt or innocence, and yet in front of you are six people who were murdered that you are going to intimately know. And when I say intimately, I am talking all the way down to the bone fragments that are presented by the coroner. But 1,500 people show up at the King County Courthouse, and now the bailiff and the court clerk have the job of somehow corralling these people and getting them in the right spot and so on. And then the attorneys somehow have to take 1,500 people and whittle it to 16. And so during that process, the process is for the juror is called voir dire, where it begins with on the first day a written questionnaire, which can be very lengthy. In this case, it was easily over 100 very personal questions for each juror. And the expectation is you are honest when you fill out the voir dire. If you are asked a question, you are not there to hide information. You're not there to alter information. You are there to tell the truth and nothing but. And during jury selection, I was ironically, as a member of the media, I was given the opportunity to actually sit in the jury box during jury selection, which was really strange to me, but that's where I was directed to sit. And during selection, I sat there and took notes. And I looked at this sea of hundreds of jurors sitting there like a college seminar, like a college lecture. And I watched as they filled out each of their questionnaires, and I wondered who would be the final 16. And the next time jurors come back, they go through the attorney interrogation, but you are randomly asked questions. And again, the field, although it's been narrowed down, it's still hundreds. And so you sit there as a potential juror while questions are thrown out there. That, to me, is fascinating, not only in the information search, but in the reaction by the potential jurors. It can make people very, very uncomfortable. And then the final day, and then this series of musical chairs within the jury box while the attorneys are dismissing for whatever reason, and they finally get down to 16. And then the trial begins. And for me, but at that point, for a juror, once you're selected, the one thing I learned from every one of these jurors, at least the ones I interviewed, but it's not uncommon, is that every person selected said the same thing. I thought there was no way they would select me. which is just interesting to me, because I went through that very same thing. So I wondered, how in the world is the prosecution and the evidence, how is it going to be able to figure out how six people were killed? How are they going to put that in order? And so this trial did go for months, and much of it is tedious, and some is very interesting. But, you know, that the finding of the gun in the Stillaguamish River, that was a great moment in the trial. Linda Teeley, the person who first discovered the bodies, it was a great moment in the trial. Victim impact statements were great moments in the trial. And then there's a lot of the tediousness. But there's a day when the jurors can feel something is about to happen. They see the, you know, running around in the courtroom, and they see their bailiff in the jury room, and she's letting them know they're about to go on this. They're going to go in a different room in the courthouse, and the jury doesn't know what they're going to see. And for me, when I sit in the gallery and I'm taking notes, I have great empathy for the poor juror, because I know what they're about to see. They don't. And everything when you're a juror, every day is surprises. Every day. Whether they are planned or not planned, being a juror is impactful emotionally, physically, and it's taxing. So these jurors find out they're going somewhere, and so they're going to go that morning, and then the judge says, no, we're going to move that to the afternoon. So the jurors still waiting, what are we doing? And then finally they come back after lunch. And the court takes them down to the from the ninth floor to the first floor of the building, and they are led into this back room on the first floor down this hallway, and they see some police tape, and they see, is this a storage room? They see chairs stacked, and where are they going? What are they doing? But they are doing what jurors do. They are lambs to the law. They follow the bailiff where they need to go, and she leads them into this big room. And there are, at this point, there were 15 jurors. There are 15 chairs lined up in a series of four rows, and the jurors are sat, and then the judge is there. They are sworn in, and then the prosecutor, Scott O'Toole, steps forward, and in front of them is the exact replication, forensic replication, of the murder scene where all six victims were killed. Everything from the blood spatter on the floor, to the blood spatter on the walls, to the bullet hole in the TV, to the actual furniture, the love seat where Erica and the children died, everything set up as if it were Christmas Eve. The only thing you're missing is the smell of the roast in the oven. And the jury is then via Dr. Harrop, the medical examiner, and Scott O'Toole through their interchange. The jury has then walked through virtually every blood stain and every bullet hole they see, and they are given a description of the living room as forensically interpreted. And at some point, the defense asks their very few questions, and then Scott says to the judge, would there be any objection if the jurors actually could walk through this recreated scene? And the judge and Dr. Harris say, nope, there should be no harm in that. And so the jurors are given an opportunity to walk in this living room. And it's not a big living room, say 15 by 15. But you see the two perpendicular couches, the coffee table where Judy had laid the treats for that Christmas Eve, the TV with the bullet hole, the drapes with Scott's blood impacted all, 6 feet down the drapes. You see the Afghan rack where one of the bullets had gone through. And the jurors are given that opportunity to walk. And only three or four jurors out of the 15 actually walked on that floor and looked at the scene. And it's not that they're going to discover something that hasn't been learned, but the court wanted to give them the opportunity to feel the impact of this tragedy. So at the end of the trial, when I was interviewing jurors, four I interviewed, three did not take the opportunity to walk through that living room. And I asked why. Why not? You had the opportunity to look, And the response I got was, it's hallowed ground. I didn't feel I should be there. And then there was the juror who did walk through. And she said, no, I think it was important to feel the impact of what they did, to see what they did. This would be important to me in deliberations. And it was. But that was the climax of the trial, was the scene recreated exactly as it had been in Carnation on Christmas Eve 2007.
You also talk about having the jurors feel some impact, but also what you chronicle in the book is that there's a big screen and there is flashed things like the autopsy photo of all the people murdered, including a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old. Isn't that correct?
Yes. That part, just sitting in the gallery, it brings emotion and tears to your eyes, and you're incredulous and you have anger. But when you're a juror, you have all of that, but you also have ownership and responsibility. And when you elevate that thought process to that level, each picture not only becomes part of your memory the rest of your life, as it was with these jurors, they impact to the point where long after the trial, many jurors do suffer from post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Sure.
Because it is one thing hearing about somebody being shot in the face. It is another to see that person on an autopsy table. And another when you're looking at blood spatter evidence. And this whole case, both trials, the not to put Wayne, Judy, Scott, or Erica on a lesser plane, but once you have children, a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old, you have beyond the pale, and you have jurors who have children exactly the same age as the victim. And those jurors were picked because they had children the same age as the victim. And that is something that will never leave jurors. But when you have that ownership and responsibility, a job to do in that jury box, it is a hard, it is one of the most difficult tasks a person could ever be given in their life.
You chronicle in your book something that I've never seen before, somebody, this disruptive force in the trial, and the judge, I thought, was very, very diplomatic and very patient. And this woman claimed to be a pro se attorney. So explain what she explained as the definition of pro se attorney. What was she doing there on behalf of the defendant? And just tell us just a little bit about what she was trying to do and what kind of, like I already mentioned, he's a disruptive force. Tell us a little bit about this pro se attorney at trial.
Well, the first thing, Dan, is there is no such thing as a pro se attorney. You go pro se. You are represented pro se. And pro se means representation. You represent yourself in lieu of an attorney, even though one has been offered to you. This, I call her Miss Redacted in the book.
Yeah.
And I remember I had a conversation with Sarah Jean from the Seattle Times, who's in the courtroom quite often. We share notes and information and so on. And she said, "Why are you writing about this Miss Redacted? If you give attention, then more people will be out there like that." And that's what she wants. And what was important, and this girl, Miss Redacted, was, as you saw in the book and as our potential readers will see, at random moments throughout the trial, the judge is supervising the case. The attorneys are doing what they need to do. And the most important thing that goes on, you have to remember, this was the most expensive trial in Washington state history. And we're talking in between Joseph and Michelle in the tens of millions of dollars. This is not a thing to be taken lightly. And and it's not only the case itself. Remember, 1,500 jurors were summoned with 16 chosen to be in the jury box. The court is going to do everything it can to information flow to the jurors. Now you have an X factor, and the X factor is a person who just starts talking out loud to the judge during the trial. The gallery is not an audience, or the gallery is an audience, but it's not meant to interplay with the court at all in any way. And this girl kept saying things and confronting the judge. And she would say, "Well, I'm a pro se attorney." And I have to commend both the defense and prosecuting attorneys for not reacting out loud or taking this personal. And Judge Ramsdell did handle her well. He had to protect the trial and the juror. And my concern, and we lost a juror in this trial, and I can comfortably say, had it not been for Ms. Redacted, the court would not have lost Juror 16, because in her vocal exclamations, she mentioned something about the Maximo trial. These jurors, not only were they really not to know about, they could know the murders happened, but could not know really about the murders. That's why they were selected. And then you have this random person in the gallery, Miss Redacted, who gives them information about Joseph McEnroe, and everything about Joseph McEnroe was supposed to be excluded from this trial. If you can believe that, it's hard to do, but that's why this whole thing became two books. But Miss Redacted is also a symbol for people like her that do this in high-profile trials all over the country. It is not that this person was all vocal in the gallery. It was the first time this ever happened. No. When I was at Jody Arias, it was a factor we had to deal with. When I was a juror myself, it was a factor we had to deal with. And maybe not to the degree that this person was in the book, but the thing that was important to me in the book, and I kept emotion at bay, but the thing that is very frustrating for a judge, is it would be much easier to kick a person out and call it a day. And Judge Ramsdell didn't. He's fair, he's balanced, he let her have her peace. But people like this are dangerous for trials. They're just dangerous. And it is my belief that if you are in the gallery and you are allowed to watch the trial, we have courts that are open to the public. You are not to say anything. You are to be seen and not heard, literally. So there was frustration not only from Judge Ramsdell and irritation from the attorneys who did a great job of keeping calm, but the family. And the family is in the gallery, the family of the victims. And the fact that they have to hear this rubbish is really an insult to them, to the victims, and to the process of justice. Now, in talking to Sarah Dean from the Seattle Times, she'll never put that in a newspaper. I understand that. But I, as a writer of books, I think all facets of the trial are important, all facets of what the jury sees. So although her actions did not cause a mistrial, they came darn close.
You talk about Michelle Anderson exercising her right to testify, but notifying her lawyers at the very last minute and them advising against it. Explain what this lack of timing did for her and what the judge's response was and what ultimately, even though she had the right, what happened with this idea to testify on her own behalf.
It was... As a defendant, you have a right to testify. Absolutely. But as for those who watch trials or are in the business and see this as a regular thing, oftentimes in the guilt phase, it is not advisable and it's often not seen that the defendant will get up on the stand. I mean, all sorts of issues. Now, if death were on the table, it's a different story. Because in the death penalty phase of the trial, you're not deciding guilt, you're deciding on more of those untouchable things. So it's important that you see and feel the genuineness of the defendant and hopefully remorse. All of that information for the jury may mitigate them to the point where they don't give the defendant death. So there came a day, Michelle Anderson had made it clear with, first of all, if I may back up, Dan, the trial actually started 2 weeks late because her defense attorneys said, "We can't do it, Your Honor." They filled out a motion and everything and asked to be lifted of the responsibility of defending Michelle because she would not communicate with them. As a matter of fact, she had not communicated with her attorneys in over 7 years, as the motion stated. So the trial was supposed to start. The motion went through. It got delayed. And the judge said, "Nope, you're in. We got to have you." And that's that. So they had this. They had a very difficult task in front of them, trying to defend a defendant who wouldn't tell them anything, who resented them, who these were attorneys given to her by our tax dollars. She She didn't have to pay a dime for these. We give her these attorneys, but she wouldn't communicate with them. So they had a weak case. Even the opening statement, the defense didn't give an opening statement. They had nothing to work with. She wouldn't communicate. So it comes toward the very end of the trial before the jury is sent back for deliberations. And all of a sudden, Michelle blurts out that this is not fair. She wants new attorneys, and she wants to get on the stand. Oh, my goodness. And that day, everything went upside down and crazy. And you could see the judge rubbing his forehead. The prosecution, however, took it cool as a cucumber, because when he made his presentation to the judge after Michelle said, I want to testify, well, Judge Ramsdell didn't see it coming. The defense attorneys didn't see it coming. So the judge explains to it, if you do, this is, I don't recommend it at this point in time, but it is, of course, your option. But when Scott O'Toole presented his case, he said, I want to make it clear that the questioning of the witness will be unfailing, intense, and without reproach. And by the time lunch rolled around and after lunch, Michelle, who I believe was friends or an acquaintance of Miss Redacted, spat out some lines that were identical to things Miss Redacted had said in court about her constitutional rights were being violated, and I'm gonna find my own attorneys. Okay, I won't testify. I decided not to testify. But for a moment there, we thought she would get on the stand. And if she had done that, it would have been legally, it just really would have been suicide.
We haven't spoken about basically when you talked about the contradictory statements they both made and the police having to sort through those, and of course, the courts having to line them those statements up against the forensic evidence, so they have to sort through all that. What exactly was her position in terms of culpability in this? Did she downplay her responsibility? What exactly did she say in response that was contradictory to forensic evidence and still something that she maintained throughout?
She was very, very, very protective of Joseph McEnroe. Beginning with her confession on December 26th, she took responsibility. It took her an hour to actually get there in this interview, but she took responsibility. The lies were, a lot of them were rooted in, well, Joseph only did what I told him to do. Joseph wouldn't have done this if it weren't for me. That's true. But Joseph then took the opportunity to really try and convince everybody that it was all Michelle. She made me do it. I was the victim. And he really was like that. This is 8 years after the fact, but he really portrayed himself like that. The victim. She made me do it. Oh, I wouldn't have done it if it weren't for her. It's just not true. And I'll tell you this, Dan, once you get the visual of who Michelle is, one of the first things you realize is she isn't very smart. Matter of fact, you could say comfortably, she's dumb. And the thing that bothered me and bothered the jurors, because they look at her, as a jury, you look at the defendant. And the thing that bothered them was not only how she could do it, but realistically, if you decide, Dan, I want to murder somebody, and you go to execute that plan to kill one person, how many things can go wrong to prevent you from doing that? There's a million things. So how in the world did this very stupid girl, Michelle Anderson, somehow, without getting one scratch on her, one defensive or offensive wound on her, how was she able to execute six people in two different time periods, within two of the people being 300-pound men? How did she pull that up? And it sure wasn't, oh, shoot him, Joe. It much more than that. There was planning. There was execution. If Michelle and Joe had not met each other, I do not think these murders ever would have happened. But Michelle was just mentally incapable of manifesting a plan like this and having it work out like that. Joe, on the other hand, as he said in his trial, as Scott O'Toole eloquently pointed out and had him trapped in the corner when he caught him, when Wayne and Judy were killed and they were lying on the floor, Wayne in the dining room, at the dining room table on the floor in a crumpled heap, Judy tucked in the corner by the refrigerator, dead, blood. Michelle fell apart. Oh my God, I don't know what to do, oh my God. And Scott asked Joe, Scott O'Toole, somebody was in charge. Who was in charge? And it came out, Joe was in charge. It was his idea to move the bodies and where to move them. It was his idea how to clean up the scene, not to hide it from the cops, but to hide it from the four unsuspecting victims that were going to be there in 2 hours. It was Joe who came up with the idea of burning the rugs and sheets out in the fire pit in front of their trailer. Joe who came up with the idea of rinsing everything in the bathtub so they could make the house look all normal again, so that when Scott, Erica, Nathan, and Olivia got there, they wouldn't notice anything going on. And it was Joe who made the decision to leave the oven on so that the new visitors would smell the roast in the oven, thereby thinking everything was normal. And it was Joe, after the murders, after the police made the initial visit at 5:30 in the evening on Christmas Eve, when Michelle and Joe came back, and they searched the bodies and hid more evidence and manipulated things, found the phone battery. But it was Joe's idea before they left Wayne and Judy's house for good. It was Joe's idea to turn the oven on. So what you saw was not necessarily really transpired.
You talk about, again, it's overused, but this, was there any remorse? But you talk about the matter-of-fact recitation of the events that happen when she takes in this confession, but also that there's no tears. So when you talk about Joe took charge, I can certainly say that he did take charge, but it doesn't seem like she was so upset after killing her parents. And like you say, they both planned and laid in wait for those other people to come over, didn't they? It seems.
They did. After the initial murders, it took about an hour, hour and 15 minutes to get it cleaned up enough so that Scott his suspicion wouldn't be raised when he got in the house. So my feeling is they were both sitting on the couch for a half hour, 45 minutes, and waiting for the next four to show up.
Yeah, incredible. You say the public's response and media response. Tell us how big this story was with the media, But what was the community response like? What was,
Dan, it's a really good question. As one can imagine, this was really painful for everyone who heard about it. Not only the senselessness of it, not only the two children, and not only the reasoning behind it, it impacted home. For example, you know, before I started posting on the, I would attend the trial daily and then every day on Facebook and the various true crime websites I use, I post basically a daily diary of what happened at the trial. And before I did that, somebody messaged me and said, you know, Paul, I'm really nervous about your doing this. I'm even afraid to really even read about it. This, you have to understand how emotional this is. And she said, I'll give you an example. One of the people that I am good friends with is the kindergarten teacher to Olivia. And she can't bear to look at things involving this. Ben Anderson, Mary Victoria's son, he lost his grandparents and the rest of his family all in one fell swoop. He was only a teenager when this happened. So how does he rectify this the rest of his life? Then you have Pamela Mantle, who spoke with Erica, her daughter, every day, who was there at the birth of the children, who was there when Olivia was excited about her first day of school. Pamela Mantle had bought her that Christmas a pink bicycle, something Olivia, just prayed for. And Olivia never got to ride the bike. So this gives you just the slightest paintbrush of a stroke of the emotion involved to the people who were caught in the ripple effect of these murders. So since the murders, there was a memorial built at the Carnation Post Office. Kimberly Moody is still there to this day. Kimberly Moody still works in the same spot Judy was in, and she still thinks of her every day. When she goes out and back and sits on the park bench, the same park bench that Judy sat on every day during her break, and there's a little memorial sign up there for Judy Anderson, she thinks about Judy every day. There's a little memorial garden right outside the post office that is meant just for Judy. There's the memorial that was built in Seaside, Oregon, overlooking the ocean, the favorite place that Scott, Erica, and the children used to love to go to during the summer. There's the memorial built at the Black Diamond Elementary School where Olivia went to school. And the community got together and built a memorial outside. And then ultimately I'm working on a permanent memorial for Carnation. But this impacted far, wide, and deep in the Northwest. And the biggest thing is really the senselessness of it. And then when you add children into the victims, it ripped people's hearts out.
You talk about the 3 days it took to deliberate in this. It was, again, a long trial, as you say, and very, very expensive, and trotted out every witness, all the forensic and all the forensic experts, eyewitnesses, everybody involved with this, very meticulous. Had a defense, but like you say, not much to go on with the defendant. It's not cooperating whatsoever and then is completely guilty and has already signed a confession. So tell us about the sentencing and then what you do around that sentencing time in terms of regarding Joseph McEnroe.
With this case, with all cases, what fascinates me is regardless of how long a jury sits in a jury room and deliberates, what is that thing that tips them over the edge. It's more elusive to find that thing when death is on the table. But in the guilt phase, what is that thing that just the jury can squeeze the trigger at? And in this case, it was as if Erica spoke from the grave, because it was her 911 call. And it was them listening to it over and over and over again. And what was important about that, what was extremely important about that, was there was a juror who said, somebody had asked way back in jury selection, they had said to the, they were talking about premeditation. One of the jurors said, oh, premeditation takes 5 minutes. Well, premeditation is not determined in 5 minutes. And what the jury had to grapple with was, is each squeeze of the trigger premeditation? You know what? Most would argue it is premeditation. But the jury strives for something a little more than just that. They have to know individually that the decision they make is something not only the family has to live with, they have to live with. And in this case, it came down to that 11-second phone call. And what was important about the 11-second phone call was the fact that in that 11 seconds, Joseph McEnroe and Michelle Anderson had the opportunity to stop, to not make the next decisions that they made. It was right there. And they didn't. They chose to go to the other side, and that's what the jury had to deal with. So they made their decision, and even though there's comfort in a jury collectively reaching a decision, at the end of the day, it is a mere pittance of a Band-Aid for the horror of six murders. In other words, they have done their job, but they feel like it's somewhat inadequate because it will not bring six people back. But there is some solace in being able to collectively make that decision, but it's minor compared to what the face of the situation. So the day of sentencing comes. You have the verdicts, and then there's usually anywhere between a month and a 2 month delay between verdict and sentencing. And so for the jury, even though they are released from their admonishment after making their verdict, jurors typically will not come out and talk until after sentencing. And it's always interesting to see how many come back for sentencing. And in this case, I am pretty comfortable in saying it was 9 jurors came back from both the McEnroe trial and the Michelle Anderson trial. And they came back to sit in the front row and see the render of sentencing. It's the fruit of their labors. But more importantly to the juror when they see sentencing, it's something for the family. Although little, it's something. But there is still, even though in this case it was obvious on the surface, the six victims and how they were killed and who did it and who premeditated it, there was still that anticipation of, will the law actually work, or somehow is the sentencing going to be less than what? And they got the whole shebang. They got the banquet of consequences. And what's really interesting that I really never took note of before was that once the judge committed on the sentencing to life without parole, there's a process that starts, and it's not just that the defendant is fingerprinted. The defendant is handed a series of documents to sign. And these are things that we as common law-abiding citizens take for granted, but one of them is the right to vote. So there is some comfort to the family and to the jurors to watch as Michelle Anderson signed her way to her rights to vote ever again, as she signed away her rights to ever own a firearm again, as she signed away her rights to her life. And it was something that some of us would feel not enough, because it was never put on the table. The death penalty was not put on the table for her for two reasons. Washington State, the governor, has put a moratorium on any executions. And number two, on the penalty phase of the death penalty trial of Joseph McEnroe, the jury hung. So the state had to make a decision. Do we go after death? Well, we may end up with a hung jury, and we may never actually execute Joseph McEnroe, or do we just have the jury deal with the guilt phase? And that's what happened. So after the trial, I met the jurors. They have to meet that. But I was looking for the conclusion, the banquet of consequences. It was six people dead, two murders. The trial dealt with one, with Joseph McEnroe's trial. It happened while I was at the Joey Arias trial. So there's no way I could see that live. So I thought, you know what, I'll be like Truman Capote, and what I'll do is I will go meet the killer. And although right now I approach it with some levity and comfort, it was not that comfortable when I went out to see him. I thought I was falling off my rocker or something. Why in the world would I want to do this? Why would I want to risk upsetting the family by going and seeing him? And it would upset the family because you're giving attention to his name, where the names that should be remembered are the victims, not him.
Right.
But I had questions, and my thing, as you and I had discussed earlier, was that Michelle, at the end of the day, convicted, life without parole or not, it was really hard to see how she was able to do all of that. So I thought, we'll go visit McEnroe, we'll hear what he has to say. People said he had remorse. Let's see if he's got it. And then there you go. There's the end of the book. And we'll call it a day. So I went out and I sat with him for 7 hours. Mind you, it took 3 months to actually get the interview. And then you go for background checks and prison. And, the rules are really crazy. But I found myself finally in front of him, hands on the table, no notepad, no pen, no recording devices, no cell phones. What do you talk about for 7 hours? Well, what I wanted to talk about is what happened and how could you do that? Really, how could you do that? I wanted to see kind of inside his head, and thinking he showed remorse, part of remorse. What goes part and parcel with remorse is truth. If you're remorseful, you're truthful. That's how that works. So I thought, this is what I was going to get. So I did the interview, and then I left Walla Walla Prison. I drove through the gorge, ended up inside, saw the memorial, cried my heart out, went back home, finished the book. And one thing I do before I finish books, or when I finish books, before I don't just put it out there. What I want, or what is extremely important to me, is that the jurors I've interviewed read the book ahead of time. The family, most importantly, needs to read the book when it's a paper manuscript before it goes out there. I give it to Pamela Mantle. She loved the book. I was honored. Gave it to the jurors from both trials. The jurors from the Michelle Anderson trial said, wow, great book, loved it, loved that end with Joseph McEnroe. But the jury foreman from Joseph McEnroe, she wrote me a long letter, and she said, even though we are family, and I know what your intent is when you wrote this, she said, you're wrong. And then Scott O'Toole, I had sent him a copy because he help me on various things, questions throughout the trial. I sent a copy to him. I want the prosecutor's approval before I put this out to the public. I said, you know what? I love the book. He said, but you are wrong. And from that came the new book, which I'm looking to release this winter, called Beyond the Pale, Road Juror, the Joseph McEnroe Death Penalty Trial. And because of the honesty of the foreman, because of the honesty of Scott O'Toole, once I dug deeper into the rest of the story, specifically in Joseph McEnroe, it's frightening. It's absolutely frightening. But I'm glad I interviewed him. And I'm glad I took the advice of the people involved in the search for justice.
Overall, I guess we won't give too much away because this was leading up to your next book about his death penalty sentence. His death penalty trial, Joseph McEnroe. You say, again, I guess we'll just have to wait for the next book and another interview, but you say that 7.5 hours. What did you employ? How did you get through to him to get to that, despite all this contradictory information and people blaming each other? What was that one thing, or how was it that moment where you broke through and thought, you know what, I'm getting the real truth from this psychopathic killer?
Okay. There's a point in the interview. I said, Joseph, I need to ask you. He wouldn't talk about the children. He talked about the killing of Judy and the killing of Scott and the killing of Wayne. But when it came to the children, he was not only evasive, he would completely shut down. And so when I felt that in the interview, that we were getting into an area where he wouldn't talk, whatever came to the top of my mind, I would reroute and then try and come back at that night. But we'll deal with this more in the new book, but there was a point in time I said, Joe, I got to ask you, if Mary Victoria had showed up on Christmas Eve with her 6-year-old son, which would be presumably after you had killed Wayne and Judy, and probably before Scott, Erica, Nathan, Olivia, would you have killed them as well? And one of the only times he ever stopped and looked me directly in the eye, and he said, never. Now, what's incongruous about that, Dan, is Olivia and Nathan, 5 and 3 years old. He put a 357 into their forehead and fired. So what makes Mary Victoria, and that's the question I want you to ponder, because what that doesn't make sense to me at all. Now, the other thing about that interview is I used to call it a kaleidoscope of ironies, when in fact it was a painting of lies. So my job as a writer, not a prosecutor, not a defense attorney, is to ferret and pull that information out and make your decisions from that. That's a question. Why would Mary Victoria be different than a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old? And I think once we get to the heart of that, it's a frightening proposition.
Absolutely. I want to thank you, Paul, for coming on and talking about Banquet of Consequences, A Juror's Plight, the Carnation Murders Trial of Michelle Anderson. You mentioned just a minute ago about the book that's a follow-up to that, so maybe you can mention that. And any way that people might be able to contact you, if you have a website, Facebook, tell us a little bit about how they might take a look at other work or be able to contact you about this or anything else. Tell us a little bit about that.
I so much appreciate that, Dan. And I really appreciated the opportunity to be on the show with your listeners. Thank you all for listening. You can find me on Facebook as Paul Sanders. And then I have a website called the 13th Juror MD, 13 is numbers, the 13thjurormd.com, Twitter, the 13th Juror MD, and then Amazon is where I'm located. You can go under Amazon author Paul Sanders. You will see my author central page, which has got all my books, which is Brain Damage, A Juror's Tale, Why Not Kill Her, A Juror's Perspective, as well as Banquet of Consequences, which I'm honored to say has been a bestseller the last 3 weeks. And then the new book expected out this Christmas is called Beyond the Pale, Rogue Juror, The Death Penalty Trial of Joseph McEnroe. But I'm out there. I'm available. Facebook, my website, Twitter. Reach out. Love to meet new people.
Great. Again, thank you very much. Banquet of Consequences. Thank you very much, Paul Sanders. Hope to talk to you again soon. You have a great evening and good night.
Thank you, sir.